This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book, coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. This half hour is brought to you by Larson and Larson. They are my intellectual property lawyers, and they should be yours, and they are also my patent lawyers. So if you have an invention out there, you should contact them, because I have four patents and they are just a wonderful group. And Bill Larson will help you and walk you through any questions you have about your intellectual property. Because I will tell you something, that a lawyer is a very important thing in life. I've learned that from past mistakes. So I'm always happy to welcome to the program another lawyer. And today I have somebody really special. This is amazing. I have this wonderful book, and it's by a first-time author. What can I say? He's an incredible author. Michael McAuliffe, and the name of the book is No Truth Left to Tell. I am so happy to welcome you to Joy on Paper, Michael.
Oh, thank you. My pleasure.
Well, do you like to be called Michael or Mike?
I answered either.
Okay. Well, you know, you are so amazing as an author. This is your first book. When I've just been having really a lot of luck lately with authors whose books are just grabbing me so much. And this one, No Truth Left to Tell, I will tell you that it brought tears to my eyes in so many places. It is such a fantastic story about a subject that is really, it's hard to think about, because, you know, I moved over to England like 30 years ago, and I was over there, and you know, I traveled a lot to different countries. So I lived overseas a long time. And so in my mind, when I left, I thought things were getting better here. And so it's been a sort of a shock to me since I returned to America that race relations have deteriorated, if anything, compared to what I thought. And so this book, which tells a very difficult story, you know, everyone was talking about how it's just a smart legal thriller, but it's more than a legal thriller. It's a story of something that is so important in this world and in America, and you have just approached it so well. Tell us about how you came to this story idea, because it's based on a real event.
Sure. Yes. My inspiration for writing the book dates back 30 years ago, when I was, in fact, a young federal civil rights prosecutor traveling the country, investigating and prosecuting, among other cases, violent white extremist groups for hurting others. So as a young prosecutor, I was introduced to these very difficult issues, the legacy of the dark legacy of our American culture and our fault lines. So early in my professional career, I was exposed to some of these issues and some of the compelling characters. I had always wanted and intended to craft and tell a story about those experiences. It just took me 27 years to do so.
Well, when you finally did it, you did it. I mean, I'm sure that, you know, the reviews have been fantastic. But the important thing is that you have created not just the story of a civil rights story. You created a story about people who we really care about, and particularly Nettie. You have to tell us about Nettie, because just even as I think about this story and I think about her, I get tears in my eyes. How you just wrote it so compellingly, and you brought her into our lives that we will never, anybody who reads this book will never forget her.
Well, that's so nice of you. I agree. I too think of Nettie Wynn as my favorite character in the book, and in that fictional world, she represents to me someone very special. She doesn't have education, she doesn't have wealth, but what she does have is integrity and wisdom and insight and a moral generosity, an ethical generosity that that can teach us all lessons about how to live our lives. So I kind of fell for her myself, both during the creation and writing process, but you know, also when I go back and read passages, she is among she's first among equals in the characters of the story.
Well, exactly. When you start writing, it's sometimes what happens is the characters, they do take over your life. And now I don't know who you base Nettie on, if she's a composite or just one person, but I like to think that there's one person in the world like her. You know, she's so real. And then, of course, with your experience in 30 years, experience in this field tell us some of the things that you were, because you were really high up there in the ranks of the legal world here.
Yeah, well, thank you. That's also very generous statement, maybe. I started my legal career at a law school in the honors program at the Justice Department, and so my first assignment was in the criminal section of the Civil Rights Division at the main Justice Department. I still think it's probably, among of all the things that I've done professionally, the most satisfying work, traveling around the country and meeting people and helping vindicate people who are often powerless against the violent acts of white extremists, or extremists really of any character, but most of them ended up being white extremists. And then I taught. I went overseas with my wife and into the Czech Republic and spent a year where I helped start a reform law faculty after the fall of communism, after the Velvet Revolution, and then came back to the United States and joined the U.S. Attorney's Office in South Florida. So I was a federal prosecutor again, where I eventually rose to be a section chief over the civil rights section. Then I went into private practice and was a partner at a big law firm. I was in a smaller boutique law firm, and then I ran and was elected the state attorney for Palm Beach County. There are 20 state attorneys in Florida, so I represented the 15th Judicial Circuit as the chief law enforcement official for a time, and then went back into the private sector and was a general counsel for a global company. And then I decided I really wanted to teach law more and also write this novel. So I'm in a fortunate position to be able to do so. So that's the synopsis of my professional career.
Well, I have a feeling, as a few other lawyers have, once they start writing, it takes over. We definitely have a new John Grisham author here, somebody who's going to be writing these fantastic legal books, which I love always. And so, the basis, though, always of a good writer is that you create these characters. And as I said, with Nettie, she's done. I mean, anybody reading this book will never forget her. But the other characters also, let's talk a little bit about how you develop these characters. Adrian Rush, for example, and Lee Mercer, and of course, Nettie's granddaughter.
Right, right. The protagonist, really, I actually think of both Lee Mercer and Adrian Rush as co-protagonists. It may not be technically correct to say that, but that's how I envision them in my fictional world, that their relationship is both antagonistic and mutually dependent. So Adrian Rush is the young white federal prosecutor that comes in from Washington, D.C. to help solve the hate crimes and to help the community right the wrongs. Young, somewhat naive, well-meaning, but he is teamed up with Lee Mercer, who is a very experienced and some African-American FBI agent who has toiled in the field for many years. And the two of them are different, yet they are forced together in a partnership that eventually matures and you know, without giving anything away, changes dramatically over the arc of the story.
And, of course, you know, you've also built in here this story about Nicole, which, right. You know, when an author starts writing and they see this, it starts forming, it's really exciting to, as I'm reading, I realize, you know, I actually, right from the first chapter, well, the first few pages, I said, this is an author who is going to be building all the time, bringing in characters, bringing us, because I felt so strongly, I was crying actually when we got to the Nettie part, and also to the synagogue, and it was so emotional. You just touched my heart, and as I knew you were introducing characters, I could see that you're layering, trying to bring in more for us to understand what is going on, to make somehow some sense of what's happening, because it's really hard to understand that there are people like this and that their thought process and how you write about the other characters, I think, is also very compelling.
Well, good. Well, thank you. I consider that a high compliment. That's the best compliment you can give a writer, I think. I think in the largest sense, my book is about people trying to find their place in the world, and some do it well and make their contributions writ large or small. Others can't seem to find their proper place, and they become embittered and angry and ultimately violent towards folks that they want to push down so that they could prop themselves up. And I think the book tries to explore that theme throughout the events and throughout me introducing characters to the reader.
Well, of course, this is set in 1994, and incidents like this have happened, you know, for a century, you know, this type of thing happens. And it's so hard when sometimes we think, it's 2020. Like, oh, people, get over all this. You know, just get over it. Just find some way that we can, you know, just, you've lived this for 30, I don't know, really, it must be really difficult that you lived it for so long, that you had to learn all of the terrible things that have been done, and all the hurt and all the pain that's been out there. I really compliment you that you survived it, because it's really not an easy job what you've done.
Well, I think, you know, I've just been a small participant in the process, and then hopefully a contributor to the national discussion on race and criminal justice and truth and how we hold people accountable in America. You know, the real heroes, obviously, to me, are the victims of these crimes, people who have been targeted because of what they are, not who they are, through no fault of their own. They are hurt, they are marginalized. And so the book tries to humanize that process or that those events, and then lets readers in on how victims are often the real heroes of these stories, in that they find the courage of survival, but also in some cases forgiveness. And I think I try to sprinkle the story with a little bit of all that.
And you do, and even right in the beginning, you have a character who says, well, it's not exactly like that. There, you know, I was touched by the character who said, well, a foreign doctor helped my child. That type of thing, where there was this within themselves, some of these bad people were knowing that they were bad and not knowing how to sort of get out of it. And I think that made it all the more real, all the more painful to read. Yeah. But it was what was needed to really bring the reader into the story.
Oh, well, good. It is true. Some of the Klan characters, some are presented as more flat binary figures, you know, good versus bad, or in that case, bad. And others, it's a little more nuanced because people aren't always one thing or another, and you can have some doubts about your extremist beliefs, and some people rehabilitate themselves over time with an open heart, and others just harden and become more isolated. And those are the folks that are probably the most dangerous to the community as a whole.
And it is important that we know that there are people like this. You know, for those of us who, you know, don't, or at least are fairly sure we don't know anybody like that, and we don't want to know anybody like that. But it's good for us to have this understanding. And you know, this book, I think probably there's some personal stuff in here. I have a feeling who the hero is, that you built some of that in you from your own life and the goodness that that comes from your own heart. And I also, I think a little bit about mountain climbing that I just had to mention it, because when I was younger and I was a Hemingway fanatic, I wanted to climb Mount Kilimanjaro for some strange reason. I had that in my head for years that I was going to do that. That's out of my head now.
No. I actually did climb Kilimanjaro with my daughter as her high school graduation, our adventure trip together. And it was special. I am an avid mountaineer, not necessarily a super accomplished one compared to some of my friends and fellow climbers, but for me it's a great metaphor of life, and thought if it could be weaved into the story seamlessly and meaningfully, that would be something that I, as a storyteller, could bring that others might not.
Yeah,
I hope it worked.
Yeah, it did. It worked very nicely. And because I didn't know at the time, when I get a book, I never look at anything, any promo or anything. I never, because I don't want anything to ruin, you know, me just getting, I don't even look at the picture of the author. I don't want to know anything, because I want to just go into the book. And so I didn't know until after I had read the book and then, you know, did some research on you, that you were a climber and that you did Mount Kilimanjaro. So I thought, well, that's cute. I like that. That's why I always tell people, do a lot of things, because you never know when you're going to write a book, you can draw on that experience, right?
Right, right. No, it's true. I think for mountaineering, the metaphor of life is that it's both a combination. No one can take the steps for you. You have to climb a mountain with your own 2 feet, but you are usually roped together with other climbers, so you're utterly dependent on others for your own safety. And so it's that alchemy of independence and dependence, and I think that is a good reflection on how we go through life.
Exactly, and I thought I really like that you had that in the book too. And what is your website?
You can read more about the book and me at www.notruthlefttotell.com, or you can also get to the same site by michaelfmcauliffe.com.
Okay, well, it's called No Truth Left to Tell. It is available in, I'm sure, Barnes & Noble, and I hope a lot of indie bookstores will carry it, because it's an important story and one that I think people should read. One, because the subject is important, and we all need to open the conversation and tell people, get over it. Let's just be happy, everybody be happy, and not have all of these crazy ideas. And it's based on a real story, and it's written by an author who knows, really knows what he's writing about, and I always appreciate that. So people, all of my listeners, I think you should get this book, and partly because everybody should get to know Nettie. I think that she becomes part of your thought process once you've read her.
Well, good. Well, thank you for those kind words.
Okay. Well, again, first book. I'm sure there's going to be many more to come, and I will have you back because I think, a few lawyers out there, once they started writing, they couldn't stop. And,
I'll join the crew.
That's it. You are working on the second book already.
Yep. I am.
Yeah, I know. I knew it. Anybody who writes, so I don't know exactly how long it took you or how many times you had to work on, but lawyers have a great training, and that's why I think it comes through the writing. It's clean. It's you know, just good writing. So I'm really, really honored that we're on for it's your release date, and it's a wonderful book. And it's, again, No Truth Left to Tell. And it's by Michael McAuliffe. And people, get this book. It will really impress you. So thank you so much for being on the program today, Michael.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been enjoyable.
Okay. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
Wow. All righty. Well, again, no commercials today because this is an important day. And because I have on... I am like, I'm just about ready to faint. I am so honored to welcome to Joy on Paper, Martha Grimes. My goodness, Martha, I'm so excited.
Well, good. I'm glad you are. So is my cat. My cat is ravaging the paper at my feet. I think I finally stopped her. She was interfering with reception.
Well, you know, as I mentioned to you, when I was 21 years old, I moved from Michigan to England, and I bought a 400-year-old cottage in a little village. I don't know if you ever went to this village. It's called Sonning. It's near Henley. And
it's near, where is it near?
Near Henley on Thames.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And so, the village is one of those protected villages. There was a sweet shop, a butcher, and three pubs.
Mm-hmm.
So.
That sounds about right.
The perfect balance. I mean, you need some good meat, you need some sweets, and then, of course, the pub. And there were three pubs in this little village. When I first found this little village, I was so impressed that a village could have three pubs. And I discovered, of course, you need three pubs because there's one pub was sort of for the fancier people, you know, the little bit arty type of people. One pub was visited more by tourists. And then, of course, there was the pub, and that was the White Hart. And that's where all the locals went. And that's the one where I went. And I loved it. And those were the days when the pubs were closed in the afternoon. And that was wonderful. And you had
How big was this village? How many people did it have?
We had about 700 houses, I think, all together. But little some of them were very little houses.
Mm-hmm.
A very, very small village, very beautiful and protected. So they can't make any changes in the village. They can't add anything. They can't take anything away. But to,
oh, really?
So it was the kind where we had to wait outside for the pub to open for that first afternoon gin and tonic. And as you know, life in a pub in England is so much different. I mean, you can't compare it to anything in the States. It was really special.
Well, there have been, I have been in a couple of so-called pubs in D.C., and they do make very good job of simulating the look, but of course there's no way they can simulate the culture. It's such a cultural thing. It goes so far beyond the pub itself. And our bars over here are totally, totally different.
Well,
because the life is completely different.
So,
and, I don't think I've ever seen anything around here that calls itself a pub, which has been able to really operate in the way a pub does.
Well, of course, the pubs in your books, and there are many, and there are many pubs, and most of them I think that you actually visited and spent time in, and as you, exactly that. It has a culture. In the village where I lived, they were right on the Thames, so many of the people had been, all of them, of course, had been through World War II, but many of them had been, they had those little boats that they took out to Dunkirk. So I would get to hear stories about the villagers who went to Dunkirk to rescue, you know, the soldiers off the beaches.
Oh, yeah.
There. So it's a different world, and you certainly... you, with your writing, you keep it alive in our minds.
Well, that's nice. If I could just keep it alive in my mind.
Well, you know, I was thinking of which ones I really, I love all of them, but one of the ones that I wanted to talk about is The Black Cat, because... at one point, I was also a shoe fanatic, and so I like that you have a lot of shoes in that book.
Oh, you were a shoe fanatic?
Yeah, I was once.
Oh, yeah. Well, I have never been, and I knew absolutely nothing about women's shoes, but what turned me on to this whole thing was seeing a woman... I was in a department store, and she was walking away, and I noticed the soles of her shoes were red, and this fascinated me. So I found out that this was the hallmark of Christian Louboutin. So then I decided I'd go and investigate other shoes, and I went into a Jimmy Choo store and was further fascinated by the display, and I thought, gee, you know, this would make an interesting motif for one of the jury books. Probably that was not at all the way the whole thing came about. But I found it interesting to try and use this as a clue to the solution of this mystery. But that pub. Did you say you went to the Black Cat?
No, I didn't. I didn't go to the Black Cat. I just read the book. I haven't gone to that one.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, most of these pubs are pretty, they're fairly isolated. I mean, they're pretty hard to get to.
Yeah, that's up in Chesham.
Yeah, it's in Chesham. Well, you can get to that pub if you take I assume they're still running the trains to suburban districts they weren't using before. So I often found the pubs. I wasn't looking for particular pubs, but I found some of them just purely by accident, like Rainbow's End. That was pure accident. And the Lamorna Wink, other pubs that, some of the pubs, of course, which I used, I was actually looking for, so I could go into them. And I think I've been in every pub except for the Old Contemptibles, and there was another one.
No, I've been to that one. That's in Birmingham, but you didn't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I didn't want to go to Birmingham.
Well, nobody wants to go to Birmingham.
So I just moved it to the North York Moors. I can't remember. There's another one I've never been in.
Well, the Lamorna Wink one down in Penzance. That one was you had to aim for that one. I think not many people go down there.
Well, I was down there. The Lamorna Wink, I don't believe, is in Penzance.
Where?
The Lamorna Wink is... I'm trying to remember.
Well, it was a nice drive down there.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And well, so you spent a lot of time driving around England.
Beg your pardon?
You spent a lot of time driving around England?
Oh, a lot of time. Oh, yeah. And, yeah, that was very enjoyable. Of course, that's the way I found most of these pubs. And, yeah, I guess I really went out of my way. I just felt I had to go into them or I wouldn't be able to write about them. And it amused me very much when a psychiatrist who was in charge of a clinic I went to for alcohol consumption. No, they did not teach you how to drink. They taught you how not to. We had a groups, and he would come around every day to a group, and he brought up the that my books, each one was named after a pub. And he said, why do you think that is? So I went through this folder all about how interesting they were and how they were culturally important and how this and that and so forth. And then he said, it couldn't have had anything to do with drinking, could it? And I said, oh, come on. And he said, well, really? Every book? A pub? So I thought about it later when I had ceased to drink and I was going into pubs. I found them far less interesting. I wonder why. So, yeah, I always thought that was very, very funny.
Yeah, well, exactly. But that's part of actually traveling around England. I mean, it doesn't matter wherever you go. Well, in those days, and I understand it's changing. And that's why I think your books are so valuable. And really, they're going to be historical because the people don't go to pubs, even in England. You know, they just don't go anymore. They're at home doing streaming video or something and getting...
Well, excuse me, but why do you say that? The people don't go into pubs anymore.
No, they're closing down. I don't know if you realize how many pubs have closed down in England in the past few years. It's really quite sad because the villagers don't go any. The young people don't go to pubs anymore, and so that's why your books are, I think, are so valuable because it really does show a kind of life that's quickly disappearing.
I would imagine a lot of pubs are closing because of the economy and because big breweries are taking over.
And then they make them fancy and gentrify them. So, you know, it's not quite the same. That's why I think your books, and of course, when we talk about your books and we talk about Richard Jury and how you for an American who jumped into writing a British mystery, you know, mysteries based in England and a Scotland Yard inspector, mm-hmm. You really captured him.
Well, I certainly hope so. And
well,
yeah,
he's beloved by so many people. People just, you know, of course, have been following your books and love your books. It's like we know him, and it of course it started. The first one was what, back 1981 with the first the Man with a Load of Mischief, which of course is a beautiful title, wonderful title, and always when I think about it, I'm wondering what the first person, the first agent that you showed it to, what they thought of that title.
Well, I never had a first agent. The first time I had an agent was, I think, after I'd published 11 or 12 books. So I never really got the agent. I know what you're talking about, but I didn't get this curiosity from an agent as to why I was doing this or, you know, the titles or anything. But The Man with a Load of Mischief, I can remember still reading this book and just where I was when I was reading this book. It was a book on pubs, and I saw this, The Man with a Load of Mischief, and I thought, my God, that would make a great title for a book. So that was what got me started on using pub names as titles, because you really cannot beat those names as far as titles are concerned. They make wonderful titles, and some of them are also very, very conducive to, I think, pulling a reader in, wondering what in heaven's name this means or this would be about. When I was in Mayfair one time, I walked by this pub called I Am the Only Running Footman, and I was just sold. Most of the books are, if there's any inspiration at all, and there isn't much, most of the books are inspired by these names. And,
like the anodyne necklace.
Well, yeah, the anodyne necklace. I don't know where I found that because, of course, it was no longer in existence. When I decided to use it, I found it, I think, when I was doing some history research. And now, just to get you interested in the book I'm writing now, I have written maybe a third of this book. It's a Richard Jury mystery. And it didn't occur to me for a moment that I would not find this pub. But this is a pub, the name of which does not exist any place in England. And so now I'm going to have to figure out a way to use it. I mean, there is no pub, if you read The Knowledge, you know from reading the book, there is no pub called The Knowledge in London, or I guess in any place else in England, which really astounded me. So I got around that by having a cab driver make one. But in this case, I don't really know what to do. And I'm still amazed that there is no pub with this name, because it isn't incredibly unusual. It isn't unusual at all. But there you are.
Well, you never know. Once you release the book, somebody might open a pub with that name just for you. Right?
No, wrong.
You never know. No, people are inspired by you. And there is a mystery I want you to solve for me. It's another one of your books. And this is a book that, you know, sometimes, and this happens, of course, with your books, there are many scenes that I remember, things that come back. But there is one book that you wrote that has the opening scene that I still remember. And when I wanted to invite you, I could see this particular scene so clearly in my head. And I wanted to ask you how to pronounce the character's name. And I said, you know, I'm not sure if she's using a hard G, the French pronunciation, or the soft G. And that is in your absolutely hilarious book, Foul Matter. What is...
Oh, one of my favorite books.
I love this book. And in it, so do you pronounce it Giverny, the French way, or Giverny? Paul Giverny. How do you pronounce it in your head?
Or in my head?
In your life. How do you pronounce
it? That's the way I pronounce it, Giverny.
Giverny. I do too. And I wanted to make sure that, because I've heard people pronounce French names, you know, American style with hard G's, and I thought, no, it has to be Giverny. That scene is so good. Because he is making paper airplanes. Now, my husband's an aeronautical engineer, so
Oh, really?
he tends to, you know, like when he's doing something, he'll make paper airplanes, you know, just to toss around the room. And so I'm always reminded of that scene because that is so good. Here we have Paul Giverny, which is the proper way to say it. And Paul is throwing paper airplanes, but in his case, they're very deliberate. He has names of publishers on these papers. But what I love about it, you introduce the wife and the daughter. And I remember always you talk about, you know, the wife who wears an apron in New York.
And yes.
I thought that was so cute, and I wanted to ask you, do you wear an apron? How did you get that? I mean, it was so clear. I mean, here we have a writer, and he's throwing paper, and his wife comes and she's wearing an apron. It's such a visual picture. I just love it.
That's great. Well, the thing is, since his wife, she gets all of her food from Dina DeLuca, ready-made.
I know.
So she doesn't really do any cooking except for making salads. And I just had her wear an apron because it was it presented the opposite picture of one who does no cooking. It may, you know, I just thought it was ironic that she would be wearing an apron.
It is. It's a beautiful scene. I really, sometimes you get a thrill from a scene, and I thought that was so good because first I was wondering if you cook or if you got your food from Dina DeLuca.
Oh, no. Well, you know, Foul Matter, that whole book came from exactly what I said in the book at the end when, you know, he gets a, or at some point in the book, he got a letter from his publisher, from his editor, telling him that they were returning the Foul Matter of, that's what they call your manuscript, Foul Matter. And when I actually got this, and I thought, this is extraordinary. What a term to use to describe the author's manuscript, which they were returning.
An author's beloved manuscript, an author's manuscript that they worked over and love and cherish, and it's called Foul Matter.
I've just sort of started another. I love that book. And have you read The Way of All Fish?
Yes.
Which is a sequel, I guess. And I love both of those books. They were absolutely wonderful to write, largely because I like humor. And I just got such a kick out of both of them.
Well,
the opening scene in The Way of All Fish, or I should say really the opening line, was inspired. It's one of my favorite lines. They came in hidden in coats. Was inspired by, I was sitting in a Starbucks, and these two men walked in. It was a very cold night, and they were in these really quite stunning overcoats, but they were really wrapped up in them. And that just came into my mind. And that book, The Way of All Fish, I love both of those books.
Well, they are very amusing. And they really, for anybody interested in the publishing world, I think we can see so much humor in it, and they're actually laugh out loud books, because one could be reading either one of these books and suddenly you're laughing out loud, and you look around and people say, what's she laughing about? But definitely. And you know, it's just As I said, this is the fifth anniversary of my program, Joy on Paper. And I named it Joy on Paper because I call it a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. And when I came out with the idea for the book, you know, for the program, I wanted to talk not just to, you know, famous authors like yourself, but I do a lot with indie authors, with, you know, people who are just starting off. And so I love to have somebody like you on the program because you are so inspirational. Your work is
well,
so brilliant.
Thank you so much.
It really
and I just like to make a comment regarding what you said about what your program is about. Anyone who dreams of writing a book or who wants to write a book, my personal feeling is anyone who wants to write a book can write a book. Anyone. And the reason people don't do it is because they get too discouraged too early. It is extremely easy to get discouraged. I'm discouraged right now. you look at a blank page and you think, oh my God, what am I going to put down? But I am convinced, absolutely convinced, anyone can do it if he is determined. It takes a lot of determination. But I mean, my God, if I could do it, anyone can do it. it took me a long time. As I said, I didn't have an agent. And so it just meant sending in manuscripts over and over and over and over again. And it just took a lot of determination.
Well,
so,
you've done it. You've kept us just filled with all of these wonderful stories from pubs and also all your other books. And if you would be so kind, I'd love to have you back again soon, and we can talk. Maybe we'll pick a particular number of books that you want to talk about, and we can go through them so my listeners can hear more about the story behind the book. And I want to thank you. You know, Martha Grimes, you are an institution. You are an inspiration. And I cannot tell you how meaningful it is that you have celebrated the fifth anniversary of Joy on Paper with me.
Well, certainly congratulations on the anniversary. And I am so pleased you thought I could add something to it.
Oh, you have. You have.
And I'd be delighted to come back and talk again.
Okay, and I will be in contact. Thank you again. Bye-bye now.
You're very welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye. Okay, whoa, this is exciting. Martha Grimes. Oh, my goodness. Mystery Writer of America, Grandmaster, she's number 10 who has been here on Joy on Paper in 5 years. This is fantastic. Oh, have a nice day, everybody. I'm having a wonderful day. Bye-bye now.